I say it many times in this episode, but today we're talking about a very bleak book, and a lot of our subject matter today gets quite bleak indeed. It's a really great conversation, and I hope you enjoy it. But if you need a little bit of happiness to sort of lead you in, I want to let you know about what I've been reading recently. I've really been enjoying a series of mystery audiobooks called the High Society Lady Detective series by Sarah Rosette. These are about 6 or 7 books that take place in the early 20s, about a young society woman who solves crimes all around London and in various lovely country manors. These aren't very literary books and usually not my cup of tea, but I have greatly enjoyed the little bit of escapism and fun that these books have brought. We live in bleak times, everyone. It's okay to find a little bit of joy. Welcome to your favorite book. Today's guest is the author of the new collection, American Estrangement, Saeed Seyrafizadeh. How are you today?
I'm doing great, and I'm really impressed that you said my last name so well.
I hope so. You know, as someone with a difficult name myself, it matters to me.
That actually has not stopped people in the past who have had difficult names from mispronouncing mine, but and I always say just as long as the first name gets pronounced correctly, I'm okay.
That one's easy. That's only 4 letters. That matters. But anyway, thank you so much for joining me today. I'm very excited to talk about both of these books, both yours and our book for this week, which is 1984 by George Orwell, which I'm sure we're going to have a lot to say about. But before we get to all of that, I like to have my guests talk about themselves a bit. And so, Saeed, can you tell us a bit about you and your work?
Sure. So, I can talk about myself all day. I was born in Brooklyn, was raised in Pittsburgh. You know, this might start to dovetail with the book that we're going to talk about, 1984. A defining aspect of my life was that both of my parents were members of the Socialist Workers' Party mm-hmm. in the United States. My dad is Iranian. He was born in Iran. My mother is Jewish. She was born in Mount Vernon, New York. They separated when I was a baby. I didn't really know my father growing up, the Iranian side of me. So I was raised by my single mother. They both remained in the Socialist Workers' Party. My dad actually went back to Iran post-revolution. Mm-hmm. Sometimes I refer to that as a reverse commute. You know what I'm saying? That's when everybody was leaving. And he went back to Iran in 79, and he ran for president on the Socialist Workers Party ticket, was put in prison for about 2 to 3 months, and came back in the mid-80s, which actually is interesting. As soon as I said mid-80s, and I just looked at my copy of 1984, and I see that's also mid-80s. So. That's kind of like broad strokes of my childhood and of my like sort of the DNA of my thinking and my life and my writing. As you can probably suss out, there's a lot of feelings of alienation and where does one belong? By one, right. I mean me. you know, thus the name of my current collection, American Estrangement, which is, you know, I don't really talk... specifically, I mean, there's one story in there about Iran, but there's a lot of other things going on. But there's a general feeling of alienation throughout the book, themes of belonging and not belonging, and et cetera.
Your summary makes so much sense in the context of your book, and something I never want to assume that someone's work is innately autobiographical, although I know you've written pieces that have definitely delved into that before, your memoir, some of your stories, and I definitely see the influence there given your, especially particularly the last story in this collection. You know, I see a lot of those similarities. Do you feel that, does the assumption that your work is autobiographical, does that bother you, or is that more, you know, a correct assumption for you?
Well, I think it's a correct assumption. You know, one of the issues is like when I wrote my memoir, I'm so bad at self-promotion. because after I gave the whole backstory about my childhood, I didn't even mention that I'd written a memoir about it, When Skateboards Will Be Free. Mm-hmm. When I wrote that, that was my first book, and I had no idea what I was going to do after that. Mm-hmm. Was I going to write another memoir? What would that one be about? Would I write a memoir about writing the memoir? I was lost. And so I started writing fiction. Thank God it saved me. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I realized that there are things, there are experiences in my life that don't necessarily warrant being written about in a nonfiction way. I don't know if there's enough there. I'm not sure what it is. There's something about, like, I can take aspects of things I've experienced and then expand and embellish and create a story that might not, I guess what I'm trying to say is some things don't deserve to be written about nonfictionally.
I see what you're saying.
Yeah, I think some things have got to go, some things don't warrant nonfiction. I've got to go at them fictionally. So I think it's a fine assumption to look at my work and you know, and there are stories that are far from my experience, but there's still some thread there. I don't know. Maybe every author would say this. You know, I also write in the first person, but maybe one of the issues is don't assume that I am always the narrator.
Tell me a little bit about your transition to fiction. You know, you mentioned that fiction saved you, essentially. Can you expand on that a little more? I'm really interested in that idea.
Yeah, I mean, I wrote my memoir, and it was maybe this is always how first books are, that everything went into that book, my heart and soul, my dreams, probably doubly and triply so, because it's also my life story. Mm-hmm. I was a bit at a loss afterwards. It was, you know, my mind was a blank. I had only known that book and the dream of writing it for many years, and now it was over. Mm-hmm. And what am I supposed to do? And that's when I said, well, let me try to approach something fictionally where, you know, as I mentioned, not everything that I've experienced or not every story kind of warrants being written about factually. Mm-hmm. So let me just take some of these experiences and then embellish and expand and twist things as needed and try to actually create a story of 6,000 words or so.
Yeah, that's a really interesting idea.
That has been the thing that's occupied me. You know, there are some of the stories in the book, American Estrangement, that I had originally conceived of as writing as a personal essay. Mm-hmm. And then said, you know, made a right turn and just said, let me do this as fiction. And I think it was a good, I think they were good choices.
I think so too. And, you know, to my listeners, everyone, this is a really amazing collection. I was new to your work coming in, but I really found these stories, they just work so well on so many levels for me. And it's hard to sort of parse out exactly what worked, but I think if we go through this, you know, looking at a couple of stories in particular. Uh-huh. So this is a really, you know, it's a short collection. There's an immense amount of weight behind the words. One of the things I really liked is the focus you sort of have on feelings like boredom and apathy in several of your stories. So it's kind of an unpacking of America. And through that, you're unpacking something as simple as the standard workday. And so I'm interested in knowing, you know, this features heavily in some of your stories, but how do you write about something like boredom without coming across as boring?
Geez. Well, first of all, thanks for the observation. And you are suggesting something that, you know, I teach, and it comes up often in my, I teach at NYU and at Hunter College, and it comes up often in the creative writing classes. Form and content. We might read something that's confusing, and then the author will say, well, that's because the character is confused. Mm-hmm. But there's a difference about having a character being confused and then having the reader be confused. So there's a difference, obviously, in having the narrator or the characters being bored. I don't think there are certain emotions you actually want a reader to feel. And I think boredom is probably one of those. I don't know any writer who'd want their reader to be bored. Correct me if I'm wrong. Maybe there's some purpose for that. So, by the way, you know what I just thought about? I'm sorry if I'm jumping the gun, but, and I remember this from eighth grade, because the first time I read 1984 was in eighth grade. He's works for the Ministry of Information?
The Ministry of Truth, I believe.
Yes, and his, there's all the work he's doing, and then it's going down into, like, it's just getting, like, sort of tossed away, as I recall.
Mm-hmm. The memory hole.
That's right. And I remember in eighth grade, that really spoke to me, of that kind of like fruitless profession that one could have. And they're just day spent doing this thing. Malavika, sorry. I feel like I've drifted. The original, though, was about the boredom, the apathy.
I love digressions. You're doing great.
Good. Then we're going to get along just fine. The question was, write about?
How do you write boredom without being boring?
Yes. You know what? I realize it's probably not digression. It might actually just be me trying to get out of answering that. I don't know. Is it okay to say I don't know? I'm not sure. Well, okay. I'm thinking specifically of the story ASDF. Mm-hmm. Where it's about the young man who's working in an art gallery and he's bored because there's nothing to do all day. I think the trick that I have is to set up for the reader that there's some sort of tension, there's something unspoken that's going to get revealed. He mentions, I think the opening line or one of the early lines is about that there's something wrong with his psyche.
Mm-hmm.
I don't tell the reader what is specifically wrong with it. I want them to want to see the answer or to see how this will play out. So I think one of the tricks of not boring a reader is to give them something that they're going to be looking for. You know, one of the things I show my students in class is The Shining,
yeah.
The opening to The Shining. And I play a trick on them, which is, I don't know if you remember this or if you've seen it, Malavika, but the opening of The Shining, it's a very long tracking shot of the car going up through the mountains. I don't know how many minutes it is. It's several minutes.
Right.
And then it's all, and then it turns, and then it goes into that, into these very sort of like informational scenes where Jack Nicholson needs to learn about the hotel. And, you know, it's a very long scene with the boss and there's just a lot of information coming at the viewer. So what I do with my students is we start that movie and we look at the tracking shot, but I swap the original music out with something more bucolic or pedestrian. I'm trying to think, like maybe Ella Fitzgerald, just something very kind of pleasant and nice. But what Kubrick did was that tracking shot has really, really creepy music. The original music is super, super creepy.
Mm-hmm.
And I think what he does is he's saying, I'm setting you up for something creepy, and now we're going to cut away and we're going to go into these very, you know, informational scenes. But in the back of the audience's mind will be the creepy music and that they know something bad is coming.
Right.
So I have mirrored that in a lot of my stories, or specifically with the one we just mentioned, ASDF, where the reader knows something is amiss. They don't quite know what. And I can kind of get away with portraying the boredom, I think, without boring the reader, because they have that sort of, you know, like the heartbeat of something that's about to happen.
That makes so much sense. So like, long story short, essentially establishing a tone, establishing, you know, just an idea or the sense of tension that something is happening here under the surface that can carry through even the most mundane of activities.
Exactly.
In ASDF, I definitely felt that. I mean, he's working at an art gallery, he works reception, and you know, the punching time kind of like that can definitely weigh on you to experience that and to sort of see that happen. But all the while, you know, you're getting to know the character, you're getting to know that under the surface something is going on here, and that can really propel you through a story.
Right. And I think for me with my stories, I don't always look at them all as a whole, but I think I probably have a tendency to do a significant amount of setup.
Mm-hmm.
before we get into sort of the main action. And I think that's my trick, is to, I can get away with a setup by having that kind of tension at the beginning and then cutting away from it, as you said.
Oh, that's a really interesting way of putting that. And I love the parallels to The Shining. And I'm thinking back to my own, I believe I had a high school English teacher who did the same thing, not with changing the music, but he had us sort of observe the scene, like the opening scenes of The Shining, and show just how quietly you can establish things like character, tone, and mood, and things just in an opening couple of scenes. So that was very familiar to me.
A cool high school teacher. And I can't believe somebody has stolen my idea.
I'm not sure who did it first. It's been a few years since high school, but definitely. And so sort of going along with the collection, I think if I had to pick a favorite story in your collection, I really enjoyed Expedition. You did so many interesting things in Expedition. And I think just the general premise of it, you're sort of leaning towards almost a speculative bent without falling into it completely. It's a reality that's not quite where we are right now, but it could conceivably be. And that keeps it so interesting, you know, the idea of these borders existing narrower than they currently exist on a state level. And so I guess my question here is broadly about genre. Do you find that you like to categorize your work on the basis of a genre? Is something like speculative fiction a mischaracterization? Or do you kind of let the stories take their own shape?
I think I let them take their own shape. I don't ever think about any of my work being speculative, but it's probably an accurate way to define it, especially that story, which, by the way, that the title has changed.
Oh.
It's changed to Scenic Route, and I'm going to tell you why the title changed. Because the way we laid it out in the book was the opening story is called Audition. Mm-hmm. And then the next story was called Expedition, I believe. And so when I looked at that, I was like, wait a minute, that's too many shuns. So I switched it to Scenic Route.
All right. That's really interesting. I didn't know how late in the writing process you can change a title.
Sure. Up to the last second. Malavika. So again, dovetailing with the theme of today, 1984, speaking of speculative fiction, and a huge influence on my writing, and also my upbringing of, there's a socialist revolution that's going to come, there's this thing in the future, the world is weird, we are not really of this world, we're living in a, I'm speaking now from the point of view of my parents and how I was raised, but we're living in a very oppressive society, a totalitarian society. I'm talking about the United States. So all of that is sort of in the pressure cooker of my brain. But I think when I sit down to write, I don't think genre. I have something I want to portray, which might not be the same as I have something I want to say. I just want to show something. My main concern is keeping the reader interested, as we've discussed. Some of these things also might evolve as the story progresses. I don't even know if I sat down and said that this is going to be sort of a future version of America. And by the way, the other issue is, I mean, some of these, you know, when I wrote Scenic Route, was Trump in office yet? I guess he had been, but you know, there's some things that seemed so fantastical at the time that by the time, you know, 4 years was up, it was like, I don't know, this isn't even that speculative now. I was just like pushing it further down the road, but I don't even think it was that far down. Just the idea of like the states being divided and you've got to sort of have a visa to get from one state to the next. It's not that far-fetched anymore. So yeah, I don't know. I don't think genre so much.
Interesting. Because I got that impression too, because it was just very much taking a premise rather than, you know, diving into any particular genre. And if anything, I found that more interesting because it works so seamlessly with some of the other stories. And I think the last standout story for me, which we referenced at the beginning, was the last story in the collection, which the title I have is A Beginner's Guide to Estrangement. And this story, I mean, you've referenced your background at the beginning, and it's a background very similar to what you've described, this mixed cultural background with an Iranian father. And this story places that at the forefront, whereas some of the other stories don't address things like culture and ethnicity quite so obviously. I felt that your other stories, even if culture wasn't directly mentioned, we still felt that kind of otherness and exclusion that can come with being a minority in America. And so I guess sort of tying all that in, do you feel that there's a pressure for writers who are at all different in their background to constantly represent their cultural background, or is that a pressure we may take on for ourselves?
You know, I love the question. I can only speak for myself.
Mm-hmm.
And for me, the answer is a resounding no. I do not feel any pressure to write about my mm-hmm. background. I enjoy writing about it, and I would welcome, you know, opportunities to write about it. But I have never, in my years working with editors and publishers, ever felt any sort of pressure to or push towards that direction. But let me say this, because this is a, you know, I have something to compare it to, which is mm-hmm. acting, because my original dream was to be an actor. And that's why I moved to New York from Pittsburgh. I was in my early mm-hmm. 20s. And that was a whole different situation. That's where I felt a tremendous amount of, well, typecasting.
Yeah.
Where I was only called to audition for roles like cab driver, deli owner,
mm-hmm.
or terrorist. I mean, the joke was always like, whenever there was some sort of terrorist act, like, oh, maybe my phone will start ringing now for you know, auditions. And I found it demeaning, humiliating, embarrassing.
Yeah.
And I would still go on the auditions because that's, you know, I wanted to do it. And I had to do it. So writing was incredibly liberating.
Hmm.
And what I love and I think about this collection is, you know, as you point out, there's only one story that very directly is about culture, specifically being of Iranian descent. But I had the freedom to write about other aspects of my life.
Yeah.
That, you know, I imagine we're all made up of many, many different things. And I'm not sure if ethnicity is ever referenced anywhere else. Maybe whiteness is occasionally mm-hmm. throughout. But that was the only one. And even in that one, I mean, the narrator is, he's passing.
Right.
He's changed his name. I believe the name is Donish Jamshid, and he's going by Danny McDade because mm-hmm. he's taking his stepdad's last name. So, but no, I don't feel any kind of obligation to write about those things, and I don't feel it coming from the industry either.
Yeah, that's really good to hear, because I just feel that if you're at all an other in society, that shouldn't limit the writing that you have. And I certainly hope that as we lean into getting more diverse stories, that doesn't make writers feel like they're typecast the way you describe in the acting yeah. field. And so yeah. that's always great to hear that writers are able to express their backgrounds when they want to and on their own terms.
And again, I'm speaking from my own experience.
Right.
Other writers might have a different take on it.
That's true.
But not to jump the gun, but let me jump the gun. if we're going to talk about other influences on me, I would be remiss if I didn't say James Baldwin, and specifically Giovanni's Room, which I read when I was in my early 20s. I must have been probably 19 years old. And what impressed me, one of the things that was very inspirational about that book was the fact that he had written it from the point of view of a white man,
yes.
first person. And I think he said in an interview that his editor or his agent had given him said, this is not the book for you to be writing. And he said, this is the book I have to write. But he gave me permission to not solely write from my ethnic cultural perspective. And I think with Baldwin and Giovanni's Room, he probably said, I don't want to speak for the man, but I need to take race out of this because I want to talk specifically about sexuality.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the only thing I want to focus on with this. And he did it. Yeah. And that was 19, when was that?
50 something.
Wow, good. Yes, I was going to say mid-1950s.
Yes, because I actually read Giovanni's Room for the first time very recently.
Oh, wow.
And I remember thinking, knowing who James Baldwin was, and being very surprised that the narrator was a white man. I'm wondering if I was misreading something. And then I just read more into it. And I'm like, no, this was a conscious choice on his part. And there are other books where he explores the Black identity, Black queerness, having those intersect. But that book in particular, he was very conscious in what he chose and did it so well.
Right. Does it still hold up, Malavika?
I really got a lot out of it. I think it would warrant rereads. It was my first Baldwin. Yeah. It's certainly not going to be my last.
Yeah.
And then I want to sort of take all of this that we've talked about and transition over to 1984. And we've been dipping our toes a bit in it. So this is going to be very exciting. And so I was really surprised when you chose this book. And I'm going to explain why. So for everyone listening, this is, you know, 1984, George Orwell's most well-known work. We're going to discuss this book at length. For most of this, we are going to attempt to avoid spoilers until I mention that we're going to talk about the ending. I feel like it's impossible to talk about this book without talking about the ending. And so at that point, for everyone listening, if you haven't read the book somehow or haven't encountered the ending, I'll have a timestamp in the show notes to tell you where to skip to. You know, I always like to warn my listeners about spoilers, so throwing that out there. But
that is amazing. I love that you do that.
You know, I normally just try to skate over endings in general and say, you know, if you want the clear ending, read the book. But this book, you know as well as I do, you have to talk about the ending. And so
there's the ending. And by the way, Malavika, there's another moment midway through,
yeah,
which I will not say.
Yep.
That's also a tremendous turning point. And so that's another spoiler.
Good
point. It's like midway spoiler.
Yep.
Yeah.
So we'll definitely keep in mind if we're going to spoil anything, I'll provide a spoiler warning and there'll be some of those timestamps for you all to skip to. But before we get to the book itself, you know, Saeed, you mentioned you were in eighth grade when you first read this book. Was it assigned to you?
Yes.
Same yes. for me. Yep.
Yes. I believe we read, it was a great eighth grade class. We read 1984. We read Lord of the Flies. We read Animal Farm.
Mm-hmm.
We read The Little Prince, which, full disclosure, I remember not being able to stomach at all.
Really?
Yeah. I believe we read A Raisin in the Sun.
Mm-hmm.
What a great teacher I had for eighth grade. I think it was all downhill after that.
That's a great set of books for, you know, a 13, 14 year old.
That's right. That would be a good college lit course.
Right. I agree. And I'm really interested because I read this book probably around the same time. I might've been a little older, 14, 15. It was also assigned to me pretty early in high school. And we'll get to my experiences in a bit, but Saeed, I'm interested in knowing when you first picked this book up in eighth grade, what were your impressions that first time around?
Oh, it blew me away. It blew me away. It hit me on a very emotional level. I'm also interested in why you were surprised, because I thought when I picked my book, you'd go, oh my God, everybody picks 1984. Of course.
I'm going to get to that. But actually, you know, the reason I'm surprised, and I'll just say this right off the bat, is the first time I read this book, I did not like it at all. I hated it. I absolutely hated it. And I attribute it to, it's a weird distinction for me between a book you would call your favorite and a book you maybe respect and admire. And reading this book the second time, I definitely fell into, you know, I went from not liking this book at all, you know, ninth grade, maybe 10, 11 years ago for me, and going to now, and now I have a lot of respect for this book. But I'm hard pressed to think of it as a favorite because for me, a favorite implies a certain amount of joy. And this book is so bleak. And so I'm interested in knowing, you know, how did it cross over from being an impressive work of literature to something that you'd call a favorite?
Wow. That's interesting. Can I ask a question? Why did you hate it the first time around?
You know, great question. I think simply because it was so bleak, first of all, and second of all, I think just so much of it had just been part of public consciousness, and I felt like I knew what was going on. I was 14. I thought I knew better than everybody. It was that time of my life, and I feel like some of the subtler points in this book were just completely lost on me. Some of the less, you know, noteworthy, you know, the things that haven't been as, you know, in the public consciousness, the quieter things that Orwell did were just lost on me at the time. And I was oversimplifying a lot of what I read. And now I feel like I can appreciate some more of the nuance. So I'm really interested in the fact that you love this book as an eighth grader.
Yeah. And one last question. When you, so the big sort of big ticket items like Big Brother, The Thought Police, like you feel like that kind of all preceded your reading of it?
Yeah, I just feel like I had heard of this stuff before, and just how bleak the storytelling becomes, and I just kind of lost my, and then there are sections of the book, even rereading it, there's entire sections of books and manuals that could quote it at length, and those get a little dry, and I just feel like it was a dry read for me at the time, and I just was, I didn't have the political context that I do now, which we're going to dig into, and a lot of the knowledge I feel like I appreciate having now.
It's amazing.
No one ever asks me all these questions. I normally just offer the insights myself and the guests, so I appreciate you asking.
You know what's so great about this is it's like, this is what art's about. It's like there's so many interpretations, because I couldn't imagine anyone not liking it. And I can't remember which author I just read a quote of hers that said 1984 is the worst book ever written. Mm. And I was like, how could you possibly say that? But this is what art is about.
It really is.
Well, listen, you used the word bleak.
Yes.
You used the word bleak. That's, I didn't think of it in those terms, but I think I am drawn, not I think, I know I am drawn to bleakness.
Mm-hmm.
To darkness.
Yeah.
As an eighth grader, I would have been drawn to it. Mm. I would have been drawn to that. I grew up in a bleak home.
Yeah.
My mother suffered from clinical depression. She was a single mother. She never dated after my dad. It was just her and I in a one bedroom apartment. Mm-hmm. She worked as a secretary. We didn't have much money. It was a bleak life. And for some reason, I gravitate towards bleakness then. I mean, you could make the argument, well, then why didn't I go, you know, wouldn't somebody in that upbringing then just want pure joy and escapism? I don't know. For some reason, I think also my mother was a fan of 1984, so that must have influenced me. My mother was very literate. She was also, she had aspirations to be a writer. She enjoyed reading. Malavika, I have to talk about this with my therapist, because why do I not go towards escapism then? I must have seen something that was mirroring my life and it felt, it spoke to me. I must have said, oh, there's somebody who knows I'm not alone. Maybe that's what it is. Maybe that's why I appreciated so much of it. I do agree with you that there's those long excerpts from the, you know, books before time books
mm-hmm.
that he's quoting at length, which I think I probably, speaking of boredom, let's tie all the themes together, probably was bored the first time. The second time when I read it, which was in my early 20s, those meant a lot to me as well.
Mm-hmm.
On the subject of bleakness, there's a way to read this book. You know, forget the political commentary, the fabulistic quality of 1984. It's also a book about a man who's dying. I mean, Orwell wrote it when he was, finished it when he was near death.
Mm-hmm.
And he had a son and I believe was unmarried at the time or had just recently married, and he had a concern for who would care for his son.
Right.
There's a way that this book is... you know, it's also the story of a paranoid, depressed man.
Yeah.
Who sees the world in this way. So I think on an emotional level, politics aside, on an emotional level, this book spoke to me.
I really like that, because I think that was one of the things I didn't realize the first time I read it, is the emotional progression and the emotional moments for the characters. Because you kind of let this big setting, you know, Big Brother, Newspeak, Doublethink, Thought Police, all these things take over. And that essentially becomes this book in the public eye. But under the surface, what you get is really, as you mentioned, the story of a depressed man in a sick society struggling to find what it means to be human and struggling to hold on to his own humanity. Yes.
That's exactly right. And lest we forget, also looking for love.
Yes.
And it's also a love story.
Yes. The love story is something that was lost on me the first time. And it really hit me full force. The quieter moments that Orwell describes between Winston and Julia, it's a very odd love story because in many instances, the two of them are not intellectually compatible. They have different ideals. Like they maybe don't even know each other that well as people. I mean, we never even know Julia's last name, but their motivations, their bond, call it trauma bonding, call it what you may. Their moments together are a refuge from the world. And reading this book, it's kind of a refuge for the reader too.
Yes, yes, yes. And something for the reader to yearn for, to have a stake in. Will they get together? Will they, survive all of this?
Yes, absolutely.
So Malavika, that's the emotional, and I give great weight to the emotional part of it. And then there's also the political part, which strangely, I think, was lost on me the first time around.
Same here.
What was lost for me was I didn't realize it was a. This is gonna. Maybe I was a stupid eighth grader. I didn't realize it was a critique of communism. Mm. I didn't get that. I just saw oppressive world.
Yeah.
Repressive world. That this was maybe where America was going, or where America already was.
Right.
As a child, I was raised to believe that there was going to be a working class revolution.
Yeah.
And so I had a dim view of the current situation, and then this very hopeful view of what would come. Somehow, I said that maybe I was a stupid eighth grader. Let me backtrack. Maybe I also just couldn't put the pieces together. Mm-hmm. Maybe it was speaking to me and I didn't realize how much it was speaking to me. But when you said you were, you sort of missed the political aspects of it, what did you mean by that?
So
what were you missing?
When I was taught this book, I think it was taught in a bit of the context of, communism, particularly sort of on polar ends, Nazi Germany and then Stalinist Russia. It was taught kind of in that context. And somehow, especially at that time, you kind of are taught that, the opposite of all of that is pure capitalism. And somehow I thought, this book was embracing pure capitalism as the solution. But one thing that I didn't know much about Orwell's own political views at the time, but on this read, I realized there's a really pivotal scene here. This isn't much of a spoiler. I can discuss this scene. There's a scene where Winston is talking to one of the proles, an older man who lived before the revolution. And he's trying to get information out of the older man. What was it like before the revolution? And he's asking, would you rather be then or now? And he's talking about, in all these books, we're reading all these horrible things about the capitalists. And the thing that struck me is that those things were all true per the old man. He's like, oh yeah, that happened. That happened too. And it's interesting because if you look at those nuances, which were lost on me then, you realize, well, just because we are critiquing communism doesn't mean we're completely embracing capitalism. And that was lost on me as a freshman in high school.
Yeah. And I also wonder if it was lost on the teacher and also the curriculum.
Yes.
Because I've wondered if one of the reasons we were given 1984 and Animal Farm to read, and maybe this is my own paranoia, but that this was sort of an inculcation into being an anti-communist and being pro-capitalist. But the irony is that Orwell considered himself to be a socialist.
Yeah.
And this could be one of the reasons why my mother was a champion of Orwell in 1984, because she was a socialist. She was in the Socialist Workers Party.
Mm-hmm.
And we did not adhere or follow Stalin. That wasn't our hero. Right. Our hero was Trotsky.
Mm-hmm.
And those long passages that are excerpted in the book are written by, I believe it's Emmanuel Goldstein. Is that?
Yep.
Who there's theory that that's Orwell basing that on the writings of Trotsky. So I remember years later mentioning, I knew somebody who had been in the Communist Party, had been a member of in the Communist Party, and I mentioned 1984, and she had an incredibly visceral, angry reaction to 1984 and to George Orwell. Mm-hmm. And I remember her saying, that anti-communist bastard. She was almost like frothing at the mouth. This is how us, socialists and communists get in these fringe organizations. We're all furious. And I was shocked by that. I had never thought that somebody would have that take, but it made sense because she was in the Communist Party. And not to get into too much inside baseball, but the Communist Party was an organization that championed Stalin and Russia and the Soviet Union.
Right.
And the Socialist Workers Party did not.
Mm-hmm. And
so there's a distinction there. Yeah.
I love the distinction that I was hoping you would provide some of your context, especially when I learned about your memoir, learned about your upbringing. I was like, okay, he's going to have something to say about this. So I appreciate that. And now I want to transition over to the ending of this book. And oh, so just letting you all know, check the timestamp for when we stop talking about the
end. Check that timestamp.
Timestamp.
I want to hear this.
So this book, what I found, what really struck me this time around is you mentioned that Orwell wrote this as he was dying. And throughout this book, Winston and Julia and everyone know that they're going to die. That's the ultimate resolution that they're expecting. They just know that, they're going to capture us. They're going to kill us. And what happens is worse than dying. And it was shocking to me the first time and then shocking to me all over again that we have found something worse than death. And it was so much more horrifying.
And the worse than death, Malavika, what are you saying is the worst than death there?
The worst than death is being taken your own thoughts away from you and taken your own beliefs away from you. You're not merely meant to espouse what the party believes, but their goal was to make you believe in the party and change your entire thought pattern and strip away, what was making you human to begin with.
Yeah. Well, and that might be another reason why this book spoke to me. Because as a child, and maybe many children feel this way, although I think it was more extreme in my case, was that I don't think there was freedom of thought in my, not I don't think, let me back up. There was not freedom of thought in my household. I had to believe that there was a revolution coming, that there was a certain way to think about things, that it wasn't a free and fair exchange of ideas. I'm talking about between my mother and me. There was a right way to think. I knew this from a very early age, and I took it on. So it's a fate, I guess, worse than death in the sense that you're brainwashed into this. I mean, and I've been in therapy for many years, and there's been a lot of deprogramming that had to go on in therapy.
Yeah.
And it still goes on. It's much less, but I still have a lot. There's still this tug in me towards a certain way of thinking. I tell this anecdote when I wrote the memoir about being with my girlfriend at the time, who's now my wife. And we were walking somewhere in Queens, and she was asking me about communism, because at that point I would have called myself a communist. And she kept asking me, well, what would it be like? Like, what would the world be like? Would I be? She didn't grow up political. She had very just kind of basic questions. Like, for instance, will I be able to buy beauty products? And I just kept yesing her. And, I had this like utopian idea of what it would be like. And then at some point I said out loud, wow, it sounds like I don't know what I'm talking about. And she said, yeah, it sounds like you don't. And I, at that moment, Malavika, I'm not overstating this. At that moment, I realized that I had swallowed something whole, that I hadn't really ever questioned it. Or if I had, it had been years and years ago. And I had long since stopped questioning the rightness of all of these ideas. And it was sort of the beginning. It was like it was a crack in the ice where I went, how did I come to this place where I'm calling myself a communist, yet I have no idea about any of this stuff and I'm just spouting things off. So I think when we get to the ending of this, you know, all of this is post me reading 1984, but there's a parallel between what happens with him and his brain has been taken over and he's become a believer, as has Julia.
Yeah.
Super heartbreaking at the end. God damn.
It really is. It really
But as we said, I love that. I love heartbreaking.
Yeah, I do too. And, you know, I couldn't appreciate it then, but I do now. This book could not have ended any other way. Like, this is the only way. I don't know how Orwell approached writing this book, but I like to believe he had the end first. That's just how it felt to me.
Why do you feel like you want him to have had the end first?
I just think that, I mean, maybe it's just my own approach to my own writing. Anything that I end up finishing, which is few and far between for me personally, but if I finish something, it's because the end came to me first and I know where it's leading and then I work from there.
Yeah, you have the finish line.
I do. That's usually how I write, and maybe that's a flaw in my own writing, but that's usually what comes to me first. Something like this ending that made me feel a kinship with Orwell.
I'm sorry, I know this is not me interviewing you, but let me just ask, why do you say that's a flaw in your own writing?
Maybe relying on a fully formed ending is what prevents me from finishing a lot of my own work.
I see. Yeah. Okay. That's good. I hear you. I'll tell you, there's nothing nicer than starting out a story and knowing where it's going to go.
I've
got the finish line, but sometimes there's a bunch of stories in the collection where I didn't know where it was going to go. I kind of like, it was like me groping through the fog. Maybe I had I knew only 20 feet ahead. And sometimes if you just dive into it, not for me to just like give you like a self-help guy here, but sometimes if you just push through like the brain, at some point for me, especially, I get into like panic mode. It's like, I've got to figure out a way to wrap this up. And that kind of panic sometimes leads me to come up with some sort of ending, sufficient enough ending.
Interesting. I'm glad to know that there are so many different ways of doing this. I want to close this part of the conversation and bring it to some of my listeners' favorite part of it, which is suggestions for further reading. So chances are you've probably read 1984 and you're interested in knowing from our guest, Saeed, are there other books you would recommend either in the vein of 1984 or books that maybe struck you in a similar way?
Yeah, well, yes. First of all, I would, Beckett is somebody who also had a huge influence on me. And there's some parallels between, well, first we've got bleakness, we've got speculation, you know, Waiting for Godot is an example, like what the hell world are we in there? You know what, one thing we didn't, I wanted to mention was, there is something though about the bleakness with Orwell where I diverge. I would like to think that there's humor in my work. It might not be laugh out loud funny, but I think you'd be hard pressed to find any humor in 1984. I don't think anybody's chuckling at any point in that book. And this might be where Beckett, because I read Beckett after I read Orwell, where I saw, you can be bleak and you can be in a dismal world, but it can also be funny. And that doesn't detract. That can actually add, and it can also make it more, you know, can go down easier for the reader. So Beckett, you know, these all feel so obvious to me, but then there's also Kafka. He was somebody else. Again, these are, you know, variations on a theme of these kinds of worlds and alienation and, you know, turning into a bug. And
you do love the bleak stuff, don't you? Kafka, Beckett.
You know what I just watched though? Space Jam. I don't know if you ever saw that. So listen, that's Looney Tunes. That's Michael Jordan. That's pure joy. I was able to enjoy that.
There is still joy, everybody.
and then let me throw Baldwin back in there because. Okay, and then I'll throw Ralph Ellison in. I mean, Invisible Man. I think there are things that are overlapping in all of these. You know, Baldwin wasn't somebody who was writing speculative fiction, but the world that he was living in and his sense of alienation and, you know, being estranged from his country and his society and his family even, or especially. Right. There's all sorts of like parallels, I think, for me that running with all those authors.
Those are great names to go with. And for those of you that have been listening for a bit, I'll plug the episode we did a few weeks ago on Invisible Man. So
yes,
take this as your cue to really check that one out. That book was eye-opening for me. Everything I've read by Baldwin, The Little Kafka I've read, these have all had an impact on me. And so they might be bleak, but these are certainly books worth reading. Yeah. And Saeed, thank you so much for all of the insight that you've brought to this episode and for, you know, engaging with me back and forth. These are the best episodes, the ones where we're really enjoying our subject matter and really sharing what takes we have on the art. And I mentioned in the beginning, definitely pick up American Estrangement once it's out in the world. Definitely want to give this a read. And I know I'll be picking up your memoir as well. And Saeed, where can we find you and where can we find your work?
Well, you can find me at my website, which I've made very easy for people to get to. It's my last name, serafizadeh.com. It rolls right off the tongue.
I'll have a link.
I'm also on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram. And American Estrangement is available for pre-order and will be in bookstores on August 10th. Did I miss anything?